Coming up on this week's Redcast.
If they want to swim in the shark tank, they have to accept that there are sharks there.
The settlement cycle and the settlement structure in the U.S. is simply archaic, and it exposes a number of issues and problems, and that ultimately ended up impacting retail investors and preventing them from joining in and buying up GameStop stock.
The horse is already bolted from the stable, right? So we can't rein this back in. So what we have to do is place the onus on the professionals in this market to make sure that they provide sufficient education, sufficient risk warning, and they understand the risk appetite of their various client segments that they're interacting with. As an industry, we've closed that door to millions and millions of people based on one metric alone, net worth. So if you don't have half a million and above of investable assets, most of these banks and institutional financial advisor firms don't even want to speak to you, right? So they have to go somewhere else to service that need. I just feel a little bit uncomfortable where we say, actually, on one hand, we're going to close the door to you here, but on the other hand, actually, if we're going to push you into this channel where you can get, cheap, accessible education and execution, it's all on you to take the responsibility for it, right?
Our recent, Series B raise as of yesterday is really a testament to that, and the fact that you had a number of institutions, State Street, WisdomTree, U.S. Bank, and others, invest in us for the opportunity to, create for the opportunity to create a more efficient, streamlined way of not only being able to access some of these markets and new products and services, but also tapping into various siloed infrastructures and liquidity pools, and being able to kind of create this global this architecture that supports the movement of value across borders and in a very streamlined and efficient way. People comment that, hey, the market infrastructure, it worked well, it was able to deal with the volume and the pricing and differentials and everything like that. On one hand I agree, on the other hand I disagree. It certainly exposed a number of issues with our current settlement cycle, and I think going from T2 to T1 certainly is a step in the right direction, but it doesn't solve necessarily for some of these fundamental problems that were exposed. And so in creating this technology and in creating the compliance and transactional rails that allow for this, the movement of value, we believe we can get to, and we have shown, to get to real-time settlement.
Welcome to Redcast.
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 Where we shine a light on banking digitization.
Welcome to Redcast, where we shine a light on regulatory change and how financial services manage digitization this decade. I'm PJ DiGiammarino, CEO and founder of JWG, and today I'm really pleased to be doing the second episode this month of April, where we're coming back to what the fallout from the GameStop and other hearings that were held about the markets earlier this year. We're calling this replumbing the infrastructure for democratized finance. And the reason is that the individual investors have really had a big impact on the market this year. They're here in record numbers, and looking up some quick stats, I found retail volumes are up by an order of magnitude in the U.S. over the past 3 years. TD Ameritrade and Schwab opened a million new trading accounts in January alone. The Deutsche report came out and reported over a quarter of those with less than a year's investing experience actually getting into leveraged trades. And an AMF report last month highlighted that their retail volumes were up nearly 200% since 2019. So all of this new participation in the market has driven us to a really big tipping point for how we think about these retail investors. And last quarter, we saw these price surges in GameStop, the silver squeeze, the AMC, and everything else that woke regulators up And there's some real potential issues here that they started to dig into. There was a real cry for looking at market conduct and fairness. And how was this new market tipped in favor of the existing players? How could the new ones come on and compete? What did that mean about client communications, about recommendations, about disclosures and cost? And most importantly, what was this new thing called influencers and in the conflicts that could happen via social media? There were accountability cries. The senior management regime in the UK, the US Reg BI, these have all been thrown into play saying financial services really needs to better understand what it's doing vis-a-vis these new customer types. And there's a whole slew of hearings about the future regulatory framework. Been looking at everything from T plus zero to payment for order flow to crypto and CBDC and DeFi. And that's what I would really like to get into with our guests here today. I am really, really pleased to have such an expert panel. I'm going to ask them all just to quickly introduce themselves as they say hello. Richard, thank you very much for coming on board. Tell us a bit about what your role is.
Hi there, my name is Richard Bain. I operate a compliance, conduct, and conflicts surveillance program for a large US institutional bank. Previous to that, I spent a long number of years working for one of the UK's largest retail brokers. So I've got a good level of experience of seeing this democratization of sort of financial markets firsthand.
Fantastic, thank you. And Jackson, why don't you tell us about yourself and your position?
Sure. So, hello everyone. My name is Jackson Muller. I'm the Director of Policy and Government Relations here at Securrency. We're a Washington, D.C. based firm founded in 2015. Just a little bit about us. You know, we are a blockchain based financial logistics company focused on the development of a common set of rails, a common set of transactional and compliance rails upon which future value can move across different networks, both legacy and new architectures, and across different jurisdictions in a highly efficient, automated, and compliant manner. That also addresses and appropriately balances the need for financial privacy with enhanced oversight functionality for regulators. So glad to be on this call. Thank you to PJ and JWG for the opportunity.
Pleasure. Thank you. And Sam, why don't you give people a quick overview of what you do?
Thank you very much, PJ. I'm Sam Tyfield. I'm a lawyer. With opinions about the democratization of the financial markets. Most of my clients work or are involved in the wholesale markets. So this is something which is particularly of interest to them. And as I said, I have opinions about it.
It'll be no stranger to a previous Redcast where you shared many of those opinions. So we're looking forward to hearing what you have to say today. I'd like to lead off with Richard, please. I guess the first question that I'd like to get to is what of our current infrastructure doesn't work so well for retail today? And then, Richard, I thought you might be able to shed some light on what are the biggest compliance challenges from where you sit?
Yeah, thanks, PJ. For me, I'm going to summarize and maybe, you know, lead into some of the impacts there. But I think when we look at the retail, you know, investor base that we're seeing sort of come into the financial markets, I think it's fair to say across that client base, there's a very diverse range of experience, knowledge, and understanding of the risks involved. We have right down to the very novice, which you highlighted in your introduction, almost right through to the professional investor, and sort of anywhere in between. I think actually, you know, as I think about the biggest challenge for, you know, firms operating in this space is how do you balance making sure that each of those client segments can understand and manage, you know, the complexity of markets, products, the financial risk that they're taking on, and fundamentally understand actually, sort of risk management principles, if you like, associated to all of those facets. So for me, it's a really, really difficult balancing act, given that, you know, one message is unlikely to suit all of the market segments.
Yeah, it you're absolutely right. It's not one big mass. It's lots of little groups. And I guess, Jackson, from your point of view, that's got to be front and center in your policy discussions that you're tracking right now globally with regulators. What, tell us a bit about what that's all about.
Yeah, so let me try and condense 3 or 4 months of discussions into a few minutes. So please bear with me, folks. But yes, we've had a number of developments both here in the U.S. And then elsewhere, the EU, UK, and beyond. In the U.S., we've had at least 3 hearings so far as it relates to GameStop and the various short squeezes on other public equities. Interestingly enough, we haven't had a hearing yet with the SEC or major clearing organizations testifying. I would assume that will be that'll happen shortly. And in addition to that, we just had Chairman Gensler confirmed. So obviously, I think, you know, the SEC was certainly waiting to have Chairman Gensler in place before they testify. The EU, we've seen at least 1 hearing so far. I believe it was with the Econ Committee. Stephen Mayor, who's the chair of the European Securities and Markets Authority, and then Ugo Bassi from the European Commission's Director of Financial Markets testified. We've also seen industry developments as well. So the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation has really, I would say, upped its public affairs game recently. So they released last month, I believe, a new white paper covering the shortened settlement cycle for U.S. equities. And that was followed by their CEO writing an op-ed that called for a reduced settlement cycle as well to T+1. And DTCC recently held a forum where a lot of these issues were also discussed. And, DTCC is currently working with SIFMA, which is a big trade group here in DC, focused on a lot of capital markets issues, but in particular, this movement to a T+1 settlement cycle. And all of this effort from DTCC comes roughly a year after they released 2 white papers, one on Project ION and the other on Project Whitney, really exploring the potential and the use for DLT in post-trade services and processes. I think it's fair to say that the last couple of months has helped to keep me employed. We are very interested in what's been going on as it relates to GameStop. As much as, you know, I was a kid growing up and loved going to GameStop, our interest from a security perspective is, you know, what does this mean for settlement cycle and the use of DLT, especially in the settlement cycle? And then what does this mean? You know, what are the broader potential ramifications from these policy and regulatory discussions? And just a few key takeaways here. You know, again, I think there's general consensus around the need to push the settlement cycle down from T+2 to T+1. I believe DTCC has put a date of 2023 at which T1 is estimated to take effect. So we'll see how that timeline, if everything goes right according to that timeline. And I think, you know, there's an admission from both industry and policymakers and regulators that, you know, technological advancements can lead eventually to T+0 or near real-time settlement. But right now, there's certainly an unwillingness or uneasiness in moving towards that, given the reluctance in moving on from, you know, netting and the settlement process and then moving away from current processes and procedures in particular. You know, from the EU, you know, just watching that hearing, I found it to be pretty fascinating. And there was one ironic thing that I captured during it, where you had both Mayor and Bassi say, well, this couldn't possibly happen in the EU. And then they also admitted, well, we should probably go back and check our regulatory frameworks to make sure that this actually can't happen. So I don't know if that's comfortable enough to hear. And just from a regulatory perspective as well, you know, what we've seen, you know, obviously the SEC is investigating or at least continuing to investigate the GameStop related short squeeze. You know, Chairman Gensler has identified post-settlement trades cycle as well as payment for order flow as priorities during his tenure. So we'll see exactly where that stacks up among the list of many of his priorities upon entering.
Sam, let's go to let's go to you. That there's a fantastic amount moving here, but what is it? What is GameStop exposed as the biggest weakness in the firm's approach to market conduct? I mean, there's many moving parts in the future, but what does it mean right now?
So, to answer your question in an oblique way, I don't know whether we're considering the right thing here. What I think we should be doing is considering whether the current market infrastructure works generally and whether we need to change our approach to retail trading and investment in order to fit the current infrastructure rather than rebuilding current infrastructure to fit retail. And to pick up a number of points that both Richard and Jackson have already mentioned. It is nigh on impossible for a product or service provider to gauge the exact level of experience and risk for each individual retail client that it has, because everybody is different. And lumping people together in the cast of retail doesn't cover the depth and breadth of experience that these individuals have. And so perhaps the approach needs to be slightly different in treating retail customers as if they were wholesale customers and applying the same market surveillance. So coming back to your question, PJ, the same market and trade surveillance and risk management that you do on wholesale market participants. So that as long as your clients on the retail side are able to reach a certain bar, then, you know, that they, if they want to swim in the shark tank, they have to accept that there are sharks there. You know, the analogy that came to mind when I was listening to Jackson speak was a principal trading firm, which is authorized and regulated at the highest level, at the same as a large investment bank, is not allowed to deal directly on Eurex without the people who are trading passing a Eurex exam. If you want to deal on the CME or the CBOT or the CBOT, you're going to have to certify that the traders dealing there understand the rules of the relevant market. We are moving the dial, or we're prepared to move the dial for retail to pat them on the head and say, I know it's all very difficult, don't you worry, when the ramifications of that just keep on going.
Richard, that's a big statement. I mean, you led off with the whole discussion about how you think about risk management for the different subsets of retail, but I don't think you were considering treating them as wholesale. What's your view of that?
Yeah. Whilst I accept the inevitable challenges that come with it, I would suggest that, you know, the horse is already bolted from the stable, right? So we can't rein this back in. So what we have to do is place the onus on the professionals in this market to make sure that they provide sufficient education, sufficient risk warning, and they understand the risk appetite of their various client segments that they're interacting with. Now, this is not an unusual concept. it's a concept that we would apply to a financial advisor today, right? That would have to go through all of these requirements to make sure that what they're providing in products and services to their clients is fundamentally suitable to their profile. Now, here's the elephant in the room here. Retail brokers can't do that on scale sufficiently well, and their cost structure doesn't facilitate their ability to do that either, right? But I do think, actually, having spent some time working in the retail brokerage sector in the UK, particularly in the execution-only sector, I think that designation of being an, you know, entirely execution-only broker is somewhat, you know, is somewhat stretched for me. I do think they have an educational, these firms have an educational responsibility to make
it's,
sure.
I completely agree with you, Richard, that we can't put the genie back in the bottle. But what you're saying prompted me to have a quick look at the definition of democracy, which is the representation of people by way of an elected representative body or directly. But if you think about history, until very, very recently, there wasn't the people who were voting for the representative bodies was not all eligible adults. We still have restrictions on who can vote for their public representatives. Nobody under 18 or under 16. There are certain people who forfeit their right to appoint their representative. And we do so on the basis that those of us who have the right to vote should have a level of understanding and maturity that we understand what we're voting for. I know that does sound ridiculous, doesn't it? Looking around me, but it doesn't. Democratization of the financial markets doesn't mean it should be open to everybody. So if we're placing the onus on the professionals, as I think is reasonable, for warnings and training, we should also accept, surely, that some people might not make the grade.
Yeah, I mean, I can give you a real life example of that in the retail market that sort of would maybe bring that to life, right? I remember at the sort of the height of the, you know, the financial collapse in sort of 2007, 2018, I became aware of some retail brokers offering their clients very complex structured products. And to participate in those very complex structured products, you had to complete a suitability questionnaire, which basically was an attestation that you understood the complexity of the product. Yeah. Now, having went through that questionnaire with a number of clients, you know, firsthand, you know, it was fairly obvious that actually the vast majority of people who were, you know, clicking through the suitability questionnaire didn't, in fact, understand the deep complexity of the derivative-based contracts and instruments that go into the making of those types of products. So I don't disagree of the challenges. I don't disagree that, you know, in many walks of life, driving cars, you know, operating in financial markets, that there may be a requirement for you to pass, you know, some sort of proficiency level of understanding. But I think we have to be able to balance that in one sense, retail brokers can position themselves to sort of act as your guardian and to provide you with the facilitation of access to the markets. But not guide you through that process whilst you're doing that, if that's required, right? And I say that's actually normal practice in financial services today, right? In the financial, you pay a premium for it, but it's normal, right? And so I think actually it's how you do that and how you optimize that and think about your client segments more strategically that will be the key to being successful there.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Richard, because you said a high-end product. And along with the retailization of access, and I'm deliberately not saying democratization anymore, the retailization of access, comes significant price pressure.
Correct.
Hence the PFOF. And I think the regulators are coming at the PFOF argument the wrong way, from the wrong direction, but nevertheless, it is an argument about PFOF, that if you want something for free, you can't expect the service that you're going to get if you're going to name retail broker or financial advisor who is going to spend 6 or 7 evenings with you talking through your options.
Well, these are the issues we're having, in the States as well. What do you think about, when you're on the Facebook platform or you're operating through Amazon or Google? These are great services. And in some cases, there's a lot of stuff that's offered for free, but it's not actually free, right? And I think there's a couple things here, just pulling from what both Sam and Richard said. We obviously have in the US an accredited investor standard, but that standard is almost entirely, if not entirely, based on a wealth test. It's not knowledge or anything like that, right? So I think there's certainly a lot of focus on that from the policy and regulatory standpoint of how do we revise this standard to more accurately reflect knowledge versus wealth. And I think those discussions will continue. On the other hand, from a retail perspective, there's a couple of discussions on Capitol Hill right now. One of the main things that I took away from some of these hearings is that there's a real interest, or not interest, but there's a number of policymakers that are interested in seeing whether we can unmask social media accounts, right, and place a KYC on these accounts, and who's doing this activity behind the scenes. And now on one hand, I'm going, well, if we're trying to tackle nefarious activity, then this makes sense. But on the other hand, it's huge privacy implications, right? Huge privacy implications. And that certainly gets me worried. And then the knock-on effects of this as well, of GameStop have been, well, maybe we just restrict access, from the retail investors to certain products, right? So obviously what was in the discussion and in the focus was, well, Robinhood offers, options, products and that capability. And frankly, most people don't understand what they're getting into when they're offered that product. So should we curtail certain activities and products? And I guess, from my standpoint, does this end up going beyond the public equities markets and do all sorts of other markets where, we really don't want you to play in here or with this particular product or service. And so I think there's broader ramifications to these, certainly to these discussions. And on the other hand, you have, people like, my sister, who all she wanted to do was invest some dollars into Nokia in the hopes that, at the end of the day, she'd get enough for a bottle of wine. Where's the line, right? I guess that's the question. And who are we really trying to restrict here? Should everyone be able to show up and invest in GameStop? Should only a certain segment be able to? I think those are really important questions that that have much broader ramifications on these markets. And one other thing to add too, in particular, when we talk about these unmasking of social media accounts, one of the points that were brought up was a national security perspective. Right. So, if there's a nefarious state that has a number of people employed to, start promoting, certain stock memes and the like, how that could affect some markets around the world, that's certainly a concern. And so I guess, there's much bigger discussions here, but just feeding off of what, Richard and Sam both said, because I think, we obviously need to take our time here when we think about some of these issues.
Jackson, I actually think you made a really important point there in terms of how people access financial markets, right? Certainly, for me, there are two real key drivers which are driving the volume of people using self-directed, access services. Technology is a massive component part, which I'm sure we would all agree on. The other part which is important here is that, and you hit on this there, is that the other route is through some form of financial advice capability, where you can have complex financial needs addressed through that service. However, as an industry, we've closed that door to millions and millions of people based on one metric alone, net worth. So if you don't have half a million and above of investable assets, most of these banks and institutional financial advisor firms don't even want to speak to you, right? So they have to go somewhere else to service that need. I just feel a little bit uncomfortable where we say, actually, on one hand, we're going to close the door to you here, but on the other hand, actually, if we're going to push you into this channel where you can get, cheap, accessible education and execution, it's all on you to take the responsibility for it, right? And so I think that's where, there has to be a real fine balancing act here.
Are we, to riff on your point, Richard, are we in the position now that in which we find ourselves because the retail investment products such as UCITS that are supposedly available to the likes of me and you, or at least me, are inadequate? They're poorly managed. They are poorly regulated. The rules are capable of being interpreted in a way that Woodford could satisfy his UCITS obligations by owning genuinely illiquid instruments, which were impossible to value. Is that why we are here where we are now? If we had had a better democratized product range, better managed, do you think we'd have ended up where we are now?
That's a good question. Certainly, I think a factor that's at play here is I actually think there's a lack of trust in the financial services industry and the financial services professionals by the retail client. And I actually think that's demonstrated in that people are no longer prepared to pay a premium to access markets through an investment fund, a financial advisor, etc. You can measure that just in the falling rates of fee pressure that fund managers are under, right? Just significant. They're charging, expense ratios far lower, probably half what they were charging 5-10 years ago, right? So, I remember the days when you're paying 1.5%. You're probably lucky if you're paying 50 basis points now in some of these products, right? So, it's definitely a factor. I don't know if I can answer the question, but I think you do raise a very interesting point.
Yeah, so what's your take on that same question? I think you're sitting at a company that's all about the blockchain, and it's all about automating a lot of this compliance conversation and providing transparency both to the seller and to the buyer. So, is there some answer there with DLT?
Yeah, I mean, we honestly obviously believe so. Our recent Series B raise as of yesterday is really a testament to that, and the fact that you had a number of institutions, State Street, WisdomTree, U.S. Bank, and others, invest in us for the opportunity to create for the opportunity to create a more efficient, streamlined way of not only being able to access some of these markets and new products and services, but also tapping into various siloed infrastructures and liquidity pools, and being able to kind of create this global this architecture that supports the movement of value across borders and in a very streamlined and efficient way. you know, a lot of the stuff when we were looking at GameStop, it wasn't so much, you know, our interest in the stock itself or what was going on. Although the meme stocks were great, but you know, the settlement cycle and the settlement structure in the U.S. is simply archaic, and you know, it exposes a number of issues and problems, and that ultimately ended up impacting retail investors and preventing them from joining in and buying up GameStop stock. For us, it's, you know, the conversations are talking about going from T2 to T1. That still really doesn't solve the fundamental fissures that were exposed during the GameStop episode, though you could say that they certainly reduce the level of risk. But, you know, I think, you know, when people comment that, hey, you know, the market infrastructure, it worked well, it was able to deal with the volume and, you know, the pricing and differentials and everything like that, on one hand, I agree. On the other hand, I disagree. It certainly exposed a number of issues with our current settlement cycle. And I think going from T2 to T1 certainly is a step in the right direction, but it doesn't solve necessarily for some of these fundamental problems that were exposed. And so, in creating this technology and in creating the compliance and transactional rails that allow for this, the movement of value, we believe we can get to, and we have shown to get to real-time settlement.
Thank you. I guess we're going to have to move to wrap up soon. I guess my big takeaway from all this is that these democratized markets are meaning that we have clients looking for better products and services, cheaper, but a heck of a lot faster. You know, they're expecting everything to be there on the phone, and they're expecting it to be instant. And that's a huge expectation that we don't meet today for the wholesale guys. And I think as Sam led this all off, you know, it would be nice to think about this as a wholesale, but it's really not that kind of problem. What's your 60-second summary of how the democratized finance game will change the industry short term, like 2022, and longer term 2027? Richard, let's leave with you.
Yeah. So, I mean, I expect the trend to continue. I think that, you know, we spoke about some of the factors here that are going to just expedite the increase of usage of the general retail investor in these products and services. I think core revenues, so fees and commissions, are largely going to continue to be under pressure and come down. I think, you know, revenue from net interest income, order flow, sort of non-core revenues or creative revenue streams is going to be absolutely vital. And actually, I think there'll be regulatory pressure placed on those sources of revenue as well, which will inevitably lead to, I think, a contraction in the solutions in the market or the participants in this market and the availability of products and services. I think also, you know, if I look at what's happening in the betting industry, for example, you know, I can see that coming into, you know, the leverage sort of CFDs, spread betting markets here in financial markets, where there'll be caps on your activity, or there will be, you know, periods where you'll be prevented from trading based on you know, going outside of an unexpected comfort level or risk appetite level. So, I mean, in short, I think it'll be more complexity rather than less going forward, and it'll be a really interesting period for the market.
Thank you, Sam. Do you concur?
Yes, I absolutely do. And to wrap it up in 60 seconds, what I think should and will happen is, as Jackson said, what we really need to do is to sort the settlement issues out. Whether it's T plus one works or it has to be almost instantaneous settlement, that needs to happen. And we will also need to cope with carrot and stick, the emergence of the consolidation of the fintech market, as people trust advisors or the financial market or the financial services market less and less and less, want to rely on their own information to come to their own conclusions based on data that they have sourced and believe that they trust. We're going to have to deal with the edge cases of at fintech as you go from a service provider on a financial on a technology side to a financial services provider, and I think that needs to progress.
Thank you. And Jackson, what's your final message?
Yeah, so I mean, look, I think you're gonna have more and more people interested in participating in today's markets. Certainly, you know, Sam, I think you're right. You know, there will be a consolidation, and if it's not happening already in the fintech space, and especially with a number of these apps. But that being said, you know, these apps are, you know, they can provide a level of education and service that we're not simply getting from our traditional financial institutions. And so there's a reason why a number of these large institutions are investing in fintech firms and also procuring some of their services. So, you know, they, you know, from a retail investor perspective, what is the easiest way to get involved, the less costly way to get involved, in a way that I don't get 40 pages of disclosures thrown at me, but something that, you know, is a page or two that I can go through and frankly understand what it is that I'm getting into. You know, I think people talk a lot about adding more and more disclosure to things, and frankly, I think that just ends up hurting the retail investor even more, and makes them less inclined to read through them. So I think that's, you know, disclosure is obviously going to be an issue. You know, financial products and potential restrictions of financial products, we should keep an eye out on from a policy and regulatory standpoint. But the biggest thing in particular is just the financial infrastructure. And I've written about this before. I think the next decade is going to be, the focus is going to be strictly on modernizing financial services infrastructure. And that's a place where, you know, we feel at Securrency, we're in a great position to provide certain services to financial institutions to help them adopt to the new realities.
Well, thank you all very much, gentlemen. It's been a fascinating conversation as we've meandered from thinking about the current regulatory framework as the answer to realizing, there's a whole new wave of digitization coming, and it's really going to then help get this retail base into the system in a way that really changes the fundamental nature of what the fintechs and the banking sector are really all about. Very, very pleased to be following this journey with you. I thank you very much. And for all of the listeners, please subscribe and continue to listen in. We'll be having two more episodes coming up in the next 3 weeks, and I look forward to talking again soon.
You can download the podcast via Spotify, Apple, and Google. But also, I'd encourage people to come to the JWG website, which, as hopefully you will know, is jwg-it.eu. Go to the Intelligence Hub and create your bespoke library.
This is Redcast,
where we shine a light on banking digitization.